This is the time of year on television when the broadcast networks begin to go into hibernation until January, and even the cable networks are presenting mid-season finales or pivotal episodes of their ongoing drama series. Our TV critic David Biancooley evaluates the paths many of them are taking this season.
By now, I hope my position on spoiler alerts is firmly established. My feeling is that once something has been televised, it's fair game for discussion. I feel it's the responsibility of the person who's delaying his or her enjoyment of a TV show to avoid mentions of it, rather than put the onus on critics. And believe me, I know that's not always easy. I have to do it myself. There are so many good shows presented on Sundays this season, it sometimes takes me the whole week to catch up on the episodes I've recorded. So here's the deal. Many of TV's best shows have just presented significant pivot point episodes that are well worth discussing. These are shows I've reviewed and raved about before. I'm talking about such shows as Dexter, The Walking Dead, and American Horror Story. And if you're up to date on those programs, you know why they deserve the spotlight. If you're behind, though, now's the time to turn down the volume for a bit. Showtime's Dexter just served up the biggest twist of the season to date. All season, we've been following two serial killers working as a team. Professor Geller, a religious zealot played by Edward James Olmos, and his young protege Travis, played by Colin Hanks. In recent episodes, Travis has broken away from Geller and teamed with Dexter to try to catch him. At the end of last week's episode, Dexter found Geller's hideout in an abandoned church and discovered a trap door that led to a basement and an old freezer. Dexter, played by Michael C. Hall, opened the freezer lid, and his voiceover described the surprise he found inside and what it meant.
Geller. He's been dead all along. Did Travis act alone? Did Travis kill all those people?
Yes, he did. And all of a sudden, the entire season of Dexter is flipped on its head and given a sixth sense twist. I went back and looked again at old episodes. And yes, the show played fair with this stunning plot reversal. When Geller was having coffee with Travis at a restaurant, only Travis had a cup in front of him. When Travis and Dexter were out hunting for Geller, only Travis would see him. And so on. And it works. AMC's The Walking Dead, cable TV's highest-rated scripted series, presented its mid-season finale with a game-changer, too. We've known for a few weeks now that Herschel, the owner of the farm on which our heroes have taken refuge, has kept a pack of zombies imprisoned in his barn. He thinks of them as loved ones with a disease. Rick and the others, especially Shane, think of them as monstrous walkers, deserving only of a swift death. So in the mid-season finale, Shane finally rebelled by unlocking the door to the barn so the zombies would attack, leaving no choice but to kill them. It was an emotional bloodbath of a climax, made even more so when it was discovered that the last walker to exit the barn was young Sophia, the girl for whom our heroes had been searching for weeks. Herschel's people had found her as a zombie and locked her in the barn without telling Rick and the others that they were searching in vain. So what's next? I don't know, but I can't wait to find out. A few other series at this point have served up strong twists as well. Showtime's Homeland has identified the POW who was turned by Al-Qaeda. It was Tom Walker, not Carrie's prime suspect Nick Brody. But it looks like Brody may still be in play regardless, as a sort of Manchurian candidate rushed into public office. And on FX's American Horror Story, it was revealed that pregnant Vivian's twins were sired by different fathers, one by a dead evil spirit who had raped her, the other by her husband Ben, played by Dylan McDermott. When Ben learns of the dual paternity, he suspects her of cheating on him and visits her in the hospital where she's been medicated and placed in restraints because she claims she's been attacked by ghosts. Vivian, played by Connie Britton, doesn't speak, but what her husband says to her is as scary as any spirit.
I know you can't carry on a conversation right now. It's okay. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, thank God he's here. Thank God he can see what they're doing to me and how wrong it is. And thank God he's a shrink so he can get me out of here. You're right. You're in hell here. This is no place for my wife. And I'd move heaven and earth for the Vivian I thought I was married to. But you aren't her. You're a stranger to me. You actually pretended, maybe even believed, like a sociopath, that you were some kind of holy saint without sin. While you f***ed all over me. Our life. And our family with betrayal and lies. The way I feel right now, I wouldn't lift a finger to help you get out of here.
Other shows have amped up the action and the emotional stakes, too. The Good Wife on CBS is starting to pull Will and Alicia apart just after getting them together. This season seems so far to be rather aimless, but there's still time for it to find its focus and momentum. HBO's Boardwalk Empire is finding its momentum for the first time after almost two full seasons. As for the other shows I watch regularly, Fox's House and Glee seem to be having off years. Fringe is as inscrutable and interesting as ever. Desperate Housewives, and I may be the only person still watching that show as it lumbers to the finish line like an undead walker, is doing good dramatic stuff with Felicity Huffman as Lynette, but not much else. And ABC's freshman series Once Upon a Time is, so far, so good, giving us one piece of the puzzle at a time in a way that's satisfying, yet leaving us hungry for more. And that's the way it should be. But Once Upon a Time, TV didn't present so many of these good series at once. I'm not complaining, mind you, just exhausted.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of TVWorthWatching.com and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Heidi Simon. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
The popular cable TV series The Walking Dead has vanished from AMC after just 7 episodes, but fans of the show have little to fear. It will return. It's just taking a break. Variety's Andrew Wallenstein is here to explain why splitting up TV seasons is becoming increasingly common.
The mark of a great show is one that makes you relate to its characters. But the 2-month hiatus on The Walking Dead has me feeling like one of its zombie cannibals. And can you blame me? I've been conditioned by the TV business to expect a show season to run as long as 22 episodes, with only the occasional rerun to interrupt. But more and more, scripted dramas like The Closer and Psych are being parceled out in batches of 6 or 7 episodes at a time. If you've got me watching week after week, why risk a long layover that leaves me open to finding other shows? Well, TV networks split seasons for a number of reasons. If you're a network like AMC, you have just a handful of water cooler shows with which to spread the wealth across your schedule. So people will watch year-round, and advertisers will pay to reach them. It also makes sense for a network to schedule a batch of episodes so that the season finale airs just as another of its shows starts up. There's no better way to expose a new property to an existing audience. Another reason for breaking up a season is to duck competition. A Sunday show like The Walking Dead doesn't want to go up against postseason football, TV's biggest attraction.
Oh, yeah, it's Super Bowl Sunday. Let's make it happen.
Look, the reality is people don't leave their favorite shows between seasons. If you like a show enough, you'll wait until the end of time for its return. And as for the risk of losing viewers to a show in the same time slot, that's kind of an outdated concern in a world of TiVo, on-demand, Netflix, DVD, and endless reruns. But keep in mind that splitting seasons doesn't always work. A show like TNT's Men of a Certain Age took a siesta only to find few woke up for its return. But that show had other issues that sealed its fate, as did last season's critically maligned NBC series, The Event. Still, my hope is that splitting seasons isn't going to happen too often. I enjoy riding a narrative for a good chunk of the year. Is it too much to ask to give me a break? Let me rephrase that. Don't.
Andrew Wallenstein, he's the TV editor at Variety. The National Museum of African American History and Culture doesn't open its doors to the public until 2015, but from time to time, we check in and get a sneak peek at the newest additions to their collection. And the latest addition, a 1973 El Dorado Cadillac convertible that belonged to the father of rock and roll, Chuck Berry. I got to see the Cadillac for myself just outside Washington at a warehouse that the Smithsonian uses to store exhibit pieces.
Wow.
And it is a beautiful car. A Cadillac, candy apple red with matching leather interior. Mechanics have been working on it, trying to get it in shape to make its public debut as part of the permanent exhibit at the museum. With me was Bill Griffiths. He's the Smithsonian's fleet manager, which means any car that finds its way into a Smithsonian museum has had to go through Bill first. Bill likes cars, and this one in particular.
One of the things that's very rare is for as old as this vehicle is, the chrome is immaculate on this. And the fact that the hood ornament on here is factory original, it's amazing. And I think it's just a testament to the way he kept his cars.
The car is going into the museum, yes, because it's just a cool-looking car, but more so because of what it represents about Chuck Berry. Kevin Strait is project historian for the museum, and he tagged along with us to check out the car.
Mr. Berry is really a keen business man and has this keen business sense, and the Cadillac sort of symbolizes, I would say, that sort of agency and his ability to sort of commandeer his own career.
Which was a big deal back then, in the 1950s. Black musicians were making inroads into white audiences, and Berry was the ultimate crossover artist, appealing to crowds with his hits Johnny Be Good and rock and roll music.
That's why I go for that rock and roll music, any old way you choose it.
But Strait says what made him so unusual was his business skill. Instead of surrendering his career to an agent or a record label, Berry drove his Cadillac from meeting to meeting, making his own music and his own deals.
For my money, Chuck Berry is the primary sonic architect of rock and roll.
So Strait flew to Wentzville, Missouri to ask Berry himself if he'd be willing to donate his Cadillac to the new museum. There was a bit of back and forth, but in the end, they sweetly sealed the deal.
We share an ice cream sandwich, and you know.
Doesn't everyone when they finish
exactly,
a big business
exactly,
deal?
You know?
The next challenge, getting the 5,400-pound car back to Washington. By the way, that is way heavier than an average car today. And Strait and his movers felt every pound of that Cadillac.
Well, it was parked on the grass, but it had rained the night before. So we had to sort of push it out a little bit, gently, of course, and with gloves on. But we pushed it out and eventually put it into the truck.
Wait, so it was stuck in the mud?
It definitely needed a little bit of a oomph.
A little nudge.
Need a little nudge.
Cadillac rolling on an open road. Nothing out run my V8-4. Cadillac doing about 95. Bumper to bumper rolling side.
Berry's Cadillac also represents the vibe of a lot of his music. It was light, freewheeling, music for a generation of people who had seen their parents endure World War II, and they wanted to play, to rebel, to lose themselves in a song or on the road in a cool car.
The Cadillac is sort of a lyrical fixture, I would say. Mr. Berry would sort of brilliantly fuse these kinds of lyrics that, you know, focus on teenage life, consumerism, the general youthful obsessions of World War II generation.
Kevin Strait and the other curators are hoping that by putting this classic caddy in the museum, they'll be able to build a new Chuck Berry fan base, starting with the young man working on the car. Odell Lovedahl is one of the mechanics charged with fixing up Barry's Cadillac, and he looks the part, wearing a short-sleeved collared mechanic shirt with his name stitched right on the front. How old are you, Odell?
I am 30.
You're 30?
Yes.
Did you know who Chuck Berry was?
No. I'll be honest, yes.
But I imagine it's still pretty cool to work on his car.
But I've had a pretty quick update on him.
And ultimately, that's one of the goals of the museum, to introduce a younger generation to a part of American history they hadn't thought about before, be it the story of a rock and roll legend, his music, or his car.
Go, Danny, go, go. Go, Danny, go, go. Go, Danny, go, go. Johnny be good. He used to carry his guitar in a gunny sack. Go sit beneath the tree by the railroad track. Go,
for those of you who've whiled away the hours listening to Spotify, you may also have found yourself spending valuable time online watching Funny or Die. It established itself as one of the foremost comedy websites 4 years ago, with a video of Will Ferrell arguing with the world's cutest and crankiest little landlord named Pearl.
I'm not doing so good, Pearl.
I put you on the street.
Pearl, I'm gonna pay you. I'm working three jobs right now, working nights. I'm driving a cab. I'm inside with my buddy right now, just going over my resume.
I'm gonna smack you.
Among Funny or Die's other viral hits, an open letter from Paris Hilton to John McCain. The website gives celebrities, both minor and major, a big platform with little to lose. NPR's Netta Ulaby went to a Funny or Die video shoot to see how it's done.
Adam Scott is trying on being a director. The actor plays Amy Poehler's love interest on the show Parks and Rec. But right now, he's in a derelict old warehouse in downtown Los Angeles, overseeing crew members as they spray fake smoke for his actors to walk through.
Can we get more smoke to where they're going to be, like right in the shot? Hey, what are we making, a Cheech and Chong movie here?
The plumes of smoke don't faze Naomi Scott, the actor's wife. She's co-producing the video and says this is the perfect playground to try out something new.
They have a great infrastructure at Funny or Die where they actually provide you with one of their amazing producers to kind of staff up and crew up. So we really lucked out with them because they are turnkey. It's really great.
So the Scotts just needed to show up. For his first time behind the camera, Adam Scott's directing a skit about a movie stunt gone terribly wrong.
It's actually based on something that happened to me on a set where I had to do a stunt and there was two motorcycles that were going to fly through the air on both sides of me.
Adam Scott is not ashamed to admit he was frightened. He asked to watch a stuntman do it first. An assistant director on the set made fun of him.
And it was really an emasculating experience.
This is your mark, okay? And this is your gun. You're going to point your gun at these guys. Now they're going to charge you full speed. You're going to discharge your gun at them, all right? Keep your elbows in because we don't want to lose anything. You got about 4 inches of breathing room on either side. So let's get this done. Capiche, capiche. We don't want any accidents. Rolling!
Actor Mark Duplass is playing the part of, well, Adam Scott.
I'm hoping I'm funny and I'm hoping I don't die is basically
two
very important things.
Duplass is a Funny or Die newbie. He's happy to be part of a group dedicated to giving things a try.
Everybody's done a little writing and a little directing and a little acting, and so there's a bit of a throw your hat in and just see what happens.
So here's how Funny or Die makes money with such an experimental model: by keeping its videos cheap. Dick Glover is the company's CEO.
There are a lot that cost $100, and there are a few that cost $8,000.
The stars donate their time for a chance to play and raise their profiles among the website's desirable fan base. Funny or Die fans skew young and slightly upscale, so advertisers are also willing to experiment with adventurous product placement.
We talk with them. They go into the writer's room and kick around ideas, come up with things. Then with them say, oh, great, here are four ideas. They say, oh, I love that idea, and then we shoot it.
Wow, hits the spot. What is this, ice?
Absolute on ice.
Ah.
Absolute Vodka sponsored a Funny or Die web series featuring the absurdist duo Tim and Eric. They dump sand in their drinks and ironically criticize each other for mocking and hawking the product.
Mmm, that's good stuff.
That's really subtle stuff, isn't it?
Adam Scott's video is subtle in its product placement. The main actor is yelled at for being too scared to do a stunt.
I'll be your stunt man, okay, sweetie? I'll be your stunt man. Why don't you sit over there on your chair and get a vitamin water?
Even while they're filming, Scott and actor Mark Duplass take a break to make sure the product placement is okay.
It would be derogatory towards vitamin water in any way. We can still use that.
Yeah, because they're your sponsor, right?
Yeah, they are my sponsor, yeah.
Sometimes something that just gets mentioned in a video naturally ends up as a sponsored product, says Funny or Die CEO Dick Glover.
There'll be times I'll be sitting in my office and watching a video, and I'll call the salespeople, you know, hey, did we talk to Vitamin Water? This is a great thing for them. And the answer is often no, sometimes yes.
Glover says the online videos function as low-cost test balloons for TV shows. Funny or Die launched two cable series so far, with a third set for later this month. Next year, Funny or Die's first movie comes out, starring Tim and Eric, the ones with the vodka sponsorship.
Shrimp!
And an inexplicable emphasis on the word shrimp. It should be noted, not everything on the website is that funny. But that's part of what happens when you try different things. Some stuff's funny, other stuff dies. And when it dies quietly and inexpensively. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.